All right, good morning. My name is Caleb. I'm a student minister here. I wanted to start us off with a few reflection questions today. The first question I wanted to ask us is, think of one person you know who went to church in the past but no longer attends a church. I want you to think of one person that you know. Maybe it's someone that you grew up with. Maybe it was a friend. Maybe it was a schoolmate. Think of one person you know who went to church in the past but no longer attends a church. I can think of like 24. Okay, got that? One person. All right. Second, why do you think you're still attending a church and maybe some of your old friends are not anymore? Why do you think you're still attending a church and maybe some of your old friends are not anymore? Think about a reason. Why are you still attending and maybe your old friends, school friends, people you grew up with are not anymore? All right, so like I told you guys, I have probably over 24 friends who fall into this category of me growing up in a church and me finding out later on that many of them have either stopped going to church, abandoned their faith, maybe they don't even believe in God anymore, they don't even trust in Jesus anymore. And I had to ask myself the second question, why am I still here and why are they not? Why am I still here and why are they not attending church anymore? My proposal to you today is that the more likely answer to this last question is not that they didn't like the church or that they just lost their faith and you kept your faith. I don't think it's as simple as that. And I also don't think it's as simple as it was all in God's plan, because that kind of went into my head too. Maybe they're not attending church anymore and maybe they gave up their faith because it was all in God's plan. I don't think it's as simple as that. I believe that the passage that we're going to be studying today, that we're going to be reading today, has a deeper answer to this question. And I think it answers why some people leave the church and why some people stay. So the answer to this question affects the way that we view our friends. It affects the way that you view each other as members of the church. And I think it affects the way that you view even the leadership, the elders, the pastors, the deacons. The answer to that last question, why are we still attending this church and why are some of our old friends not attending church anymore? Okay, so I'm going to go into our passage today. We're getting into Moses and the life of Moses. A little bit of a background of where we're at now. The Israelites had been miraculously delivered from slavery, from Egypt. Now they were traveling through the desert with Moses leading them. Moses is their leader, and there's a bunch of them just traveling through the desert, and God had miraculously delivered them from Egypt, and now they're on their way to the land that God had promised them. So this story starts out with Moses in the desert. So it says in verse 13, the next day Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning till evening. When his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge while all these people stand around you from morning till evening?" Moses answered him, "Because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it's brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and instructions." So God had already given Moses his laws. But the people themselves didn't know God's laws. Moses knew God's laws. It appears that God had already revealed his laws to Moses, his instructions to Moses, so that he could tell the rest of the people of Israel how they were supposed to act, how they were supposed to relate to one another, how they were supposed to be a community, a nation under God. The problem was that the rest of the people, everyone else, didn't know what these laws were. Moses knew what the laws were. Moses was a leader. God talked with Moses. The rest of the people did not know what these instructions were. They didn't understand what it is that God was expecting of them. So Moses would sit at the tent, and whenever there was a dispute, whenever there was something wrong that happened, the people would come to Moses, and he would be the judge. He would judge whether something was right or wrong. He would judge who had the right argument and who didn't. And he would judge between the people and their disputes, because he was the one who God gave his instructions to, God gave his law to. And he would do this from morning until evening. All the people went to Moses for help. And that's why he was pretty much having a full-time job as a judge of the people and as leader of the people. Going on, Moses' father-in-law replied, "What you're doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen now to me, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them his decrees and instructions, and show them the way they are to live and how they are to behave." And then he goes on to advise Moses, "But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases, they can decide themselves." So Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, was a wise man. He saw that what Moses was doing. And he knew that this was not sustainable, that Moses couldn't judge the disputes of all these people all the time. There was no way that Moses could decide all of these things by himself for the entire nation. The most reliable estimates of the Jewish population at that time was probably around 600,000 men. And if you include all the women and children, then that would be somewhere in the vicinity of, I don't know, 1.5 million to 2 million, I'm guessing, somewhere in the desert. And the population, just to give you guys a picture of this entire Jewish nation wandering in the desert, San Francisco is about 900,000 people with about 60 judges to judge all the disputes and determinations for those 900,000 people. And if you convert all those numbers, Moses was doing the job of about 100 people. Moses was doing the job, one guy was doing the job of 100 people, like 100 people, 100 judges, okay? So Moses was one judge for over a million people, and he was doing the job of 100 people. So it's no wonder that his father-in-law comes along and says, "Moses, this is not good. You have a really bad idea right now. What you're doing is not good. Instead, what you should do is that you should train up other people to know and understand God's laws, because God gave them to you. God told you what they were. Now you need to tell other people what they are. Tell other people what these laws are, instead of you being the only one who's the holder of all these instructions and all these laws." So Moses tells him pretty much to train up other people in hundreds, 50s, and tens, so that they could understand God's laws also and learn them. Jethro's advice, interestingly enough, is very similar, pretty much the same commandment that Jesus gives to all of you and all of us. Jesus tells us to train up other people in his laws and in his instructions. In Matthew 28, it says, "Then Jesus came to them and said, 'All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit.'" And then here's where the same commandment is to us. "Teach them to obey everything I have commanded you." So Jesus didn't just give this command to one person. He didn't just give this command to the pastors of the church. He gave this command to all of his followers. All of his disciples need to learn what his commands are, what God's laws are, and God's instructions. And he gave it to all of his followers. Every single one of us in this room, if you are a follower of Jesus, should understand that we are supposed to be doing the training also. We're supposed to be doing the teaching. It's not just one person. So what does Jesus mean when he calls us to make disciples. In the very first verse, it says, verse 19, it says, therefore, go and make disciples of all nations. Well, I think it's obvious that in verse 20, that's what he means by discipling. It says, teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. So discipleship, making disciples, making followers, is verse 20. Teaching other people how to obey Jesus, teaching other people what his commands are. And that's what, this is exactly what Jethro told Moses to do. Teach the people the laws. And that's what Jesus tells us to do. Teach the people his laws. Teach others his commandments. This is what the disciples did. After Jesus commanded them in Acts chapter 2, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, which is Jesus' teaching. The apostles were the ones being spoken to in the previous verse. So all the followers devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to breaking of bread, and to prayer. That's what they did. They discipled one another. They discipled new believers and taught them everything that Jesus commanded. Notice that discipleship wasn't done in a classroom, in a Sunday school classroom or in a school classroom. It was done while breaking bread. That means eating. I think we do that pretty well here in San Francisco. They did it in the context of fellowship and of prayer. Fellowship's just a fancy word for hanging out, getting together with one another. So discipleship isn't done in this format. Although discipleship could happen in this format, where one guy's up on stage and he's teaching everybody else, but discipleship is done in fellowship, hanging out. It's done in breaking of bread. It's done in like just casual eating and drinking and treating each other to lunch. It's done in prayer. It's done in more than just one guy teaching everybody what God's commands are. It's done in family. It's done in friendships. It's done in relationships. Remember the question that I asked you guys earlier, right in the beginning? I asked you guys, why have you stayed in church while others have not stayed in church? Why have you remained faithful while others don't want anything to do with God anymore sometimes? The most likely answer is relationship. The most likely answer is friendship and relationship. You embraced relationship, you embraced friendship with the body of Christ. That's why you're still attending church. Now, this is not for everybody, but I'm going to keep going and argue that almost everybody, I would say research has shown that over 70% of people who remain in church is because they have committed themselves to friendship and relationship within the whole body of Christ. And that's why they stay. So my question of why have you stayed in church and why have others not is because you decided to embrace friendship and relationship while the others have decided to reject friendship and relationship with the body of Christ for whatever reason. There could be many other reasons. Yes, we also have to embrace relationship with God. I'm not trying to minimize that. But what ultimately keeps you coming back and what the research shows is that fellowship, the fellowship of believers, the fellowship of people who believe in God and follow God, follow Jesus. Someone in the church probably taught you God's word. There was probably that youth worker who prayed with you. Maybe there was a Christian friend who listened to your needs. Maybe some of you were blessed to have Christian parents who taught you and modeled to you what a Christian life was. Somewhere along the line, you developed a relationship, you developed some kind of friendship within the body of believers, and you stayed committed to those relationships. Somewhere along the lines, for me, it was parents who are Christians, but it also was counselors, youth counselors. It was also friends who we were just able to talk with one another about Jesus. Those are why I'm still standing here talking to you guys. Now, again, I don't want to minimize the faith aspect. Yes, God is involved in all of this. But ultimately, I committed myself to church, a body of believers who follow Jesus, and I committed myself to friendships and to relationships. the research that I was referring to earlier, there's this article by Barna Research Group. It's a Christian research group that surveys churches on many different Christian topics. You can go to their website. They do research, they do surveys, they do statistics on many different church topics and Christian topics. And I found this research article that they had posted back in September 2013. It was originally 5 reasons why millennials stay connected to church, but I just decided to highlight 3 because five were too many. So 5 reasons why millennials stay connected to the church. Now, this article talks about millennials, which is actually defined as, do you guys know what millennials are? It's anyone born between 1982 and 2004. So anyone born between 1982 and 2004. So quick show of hands. Is anyone in here born between 1982 and 2004? Anyone? Okay, probably like a third of us, maybe. And then maybe like another few are just embarrassed to admit that they've been born between 1982 and I'm actually outside that range, just to give you guys a little. I'm not a millennial. I couldn't believe it. I feel like I'm a millennial. So if you're between like the ages of like 13 and 35, you're considered a millennial. But even though this article is talking about millennials, it's talking about how millennials think and how they interact with society. I think the results of this article are pretty universal. They could really apply to all of us, even if you're not born within this age range, okay? It's really a good overview of what might be happening. So the article listed about 5, and I'll be going to 3 of them. The first one that they talked about, why millennials stay connected to church, or why anyone really stays connected to the church, is first, they make room for meaningful relationships. This is exactly what I was talking about. They make room for meaningful relationships. Here's a quote from the article. It says, those who stay in the church were twice as likely to have a close friendship with an adult inside the church. So they had twice as likely to stick around if they had a close relationship or close friendship with an adult in the church. Another one, 7 out of 10 millennials who dropped out of church did not have a close friendship with an adult. And nearly 9 out of 10 never had a mentor at the church. So when I was a senior in high school, well, growing up, I had maybe it was because I was the pastor's kid, but I had friendships with many adults. They would come over to my house and we'd have potlucks and stuff. So I would know them a lot. Okay, so it was kind of easier for me just because of the context of where I was living. But when I was a senior in high school, there were 3 of us seniors who decided to go out of our way every Sunday after church to talk to these freshmen. Okay, so seniors don't normally talk with freshmen. If you are outside of high school for a long time, seniors don't talk with freshmen. Okay, freshmen don't usually talk with seniors. But 3 of us seniors decided that we were going to go out of our way every Sunday after church, and we were going to go talk with these freshmen. We would ask them how their week was, what they were learning at school. Now, the first week, it was like, we just get random answers and probably like just stares. But after a while, we did it every single week. We asked them, how was your week? What are you learning at school? We asked them what book of the Bible they were reading or they were interested in. We asked them how we could pray for them that week. We could have been like doing other stuff, senior stuff, but we decided that every Sunday we would pick out it was 3 seniors and we picked out 3 freshmen. We picked out 3 freshmen and we would just talk with them. And at first they thought we were crazy, but after a while we built up a friendship and we built up a relationship with them where they could actually talk with us more meaningfully. They would actually give us prayer requests rather than, no, I don't have anything to pray for. They would trust us with their lives. And that happened after many, many, many months of just talking with them, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. We decided that we were going to make meaningful relationships. Okay? Number two in reasons why millennials stay connected to the church, make reverse mentoring a priority. Now, reverse mentoring is exactly what it sounds like. Reversing the mentor and the student relationship. The mentor becomes a student, and the student becomes a mentor. So this is what's called reverse mentoring. It's where the student can teach the teacher. Now, that almost never happens, because once you have a teacher, you just sit and you listen to the teacher. That's what you do. You sit in the classroom, and you listen to the teacher, and you don't say a word. You just stay quiet, and you learn. Now, reverse mentoring kind of puts that all on top of his head, because the teacher now gets to sit in the classroom, and the student gets to teach the teacher. For example, did you know that I learned how to play the guitar from a 15-year-old girl down in Houston, Texas? She was part of our church. She was incredibly talented at guitar, and I just told her, and she was part of the youth group, so she was just sitting there listening to Bible studies. I was teaching the Bible studies and everything, and one day I just told her, hey, do you think you can teach me some guitar chords? And she, like, her face was shocked, because the youth minister just asked her if she could do something for him. And she was like, yeah, I guess, we can borrow one of the church's guitars and I can teach you. And I learned how to play the guitar from a 15-year-old girl. That's called reverse mentoring. Because the older person, the person who normally you would think that would be teaching, is now the student, and the student is now teaching. I just had breakfast yesterday also with another guy who's over a decade younger than me. And many years younger than me. He was able to offer me some really good advice on how to interview Agape Land volunteers. Now, if you guys don't know what Agape Land is, that's our summer program, and I'm the volunteer coordinator for that. And I've never interviewed a person in my life except for last year. Never. I thought it was just going to be sit down in front of someone, ask them a few questions, and then yay, you're welcome into the program to help volunteer. Last year taught me that not everyone should be allowed into the program. And I was thinking, what in the world went wrong? And I realized it was the interview process that was wrong. It was my fault that these guys were in the program, and I had to, like, figure out on the fly that these were probably not the right people to volunteer at Agape Land. So this guy who's much younger than me, in his 20s, and he said, you know what, Caleb? This is what you should do. This is how you figure out who should be let in and who should be. And he was able to give me wonderful advice, because he had done some interviewing himself for his job. And I was thinking, man, this guy is so much younger than me, over a decade younger than me, and he's able to teach me something when normally when we meet together, it's usually me kind of asking him how was his week, how are you doing with God, usually things like that. But this time, he was able to teach me, you know what, when you interview these kids, this is what you should do. So watch out, kids. I got a plan this time. So why is reverse mentoring so important? First of all, it shows the student that they have something to offer in the relationship. It shows the student, it shows the person that you're mentoring, that they have something to offer in the relationship. Usually when it's a teacher-student relationship, the student has zero to offer the teacher, right? Usually when you're a student, you're expected to offer zero, because you're not the professional. You're not the one who knows everything. You're usually expected to sit there, shut up, and learn. That's what you're expected to do. But when it comes to reverse mentoring, it shows the student that, hey, you have something to offer. That 15-year-old girl has something to offer me. She taught me how to play guitar. That 20-year-old guy who just started his job, who was able to interview some people, taught me how I could interview Agape Land volunteers. So it shows them that it's not that this relationship's not one-sided, that the mentor is not the professional anymore, that they have something important and valuable to offer into the relationship. And it also gives the student, secondly, it also gives the student a glimpse into their spiritual life. It offers the student a glimpse into their spiritual gifts and ultimately what their life mission is. You know, this girl, this 15-year-old girl, eventually made it onto a band. She eventually made it into pretty much the creative arts industry, and she's doing really well today. But I don't know if that would have happened. I'm sure it would have happened anyways. But I don't know if it would have happened or she would have been as fast if she didn't have this experience with her youth pastor, who she's like, whoa, someone actually thinks what I do is important. Maybe I actually have a gift. Maybe this is something that I can offer to the rest of the world, this musical gift. That's what reverse mentoring does. When the student figures out that the teacher, the older adult who's supposed to know everything, doesn't know everything, they realize maybe I have a spiritual gift. Maybe not everybody really knows what I know. And the student realizes that they can be the teacher also. They get a glimpse of what their life mission could be like when they're able to teach someone older than them. Third one, embrace vocational discipleship. Embrace vocational discipleship. Vocation just means calling, which could be applied to a lifelong passion, could be applied to your job, your career, whatever you are called to do in this life, that's your vocation. So vocational discipleship is, actually, let me give you this quote really quick. Millennials are 4 times more likely to have learned at church how the Bible applies to their field or career interests. So they're 4 times as likely to have learned at church how the Bible applies to their field or career interests. They realize that when students have a mentor at church, the mentor is able to show them what it means to live out a Christian life in the context of work, in the context of a job. Vocational discipleship involves mentors helping younger ones learn how they live their Christian lives at work, not just at church, but also at work. There are young people who have career goals and ideas, and they're looking for mentors who also have similar gifts and passions as they do. And they want to know, how do I take my gifts? For example, that 15-year-old girl, how do I take my gifts and apply my Christian values to my work? So these young people are looking for older people who have similar passions, who have similar gifts, who maybe even they're trying to look for a major that you majored in. They're looking for a job that you have been working at for 20 years now. And you're able to mentor them. For example, if someone were to come up to me and say, Caleb, I want to be a youth minister. How does that work? This is what vocational discipleship means. I would be able to disciple them and say, look, this is what I've experienced. This is what I've done in my workplace. And you should expect these challenges, expect these things. Same for you guys. Whatever line of work you guys are in, whether it's teaching or business or engineering or whatever it is, there are young people in this room probably who have the same passion, the same giftings, and the same desire to go into the same job that you're working right now, that you've been working for who knows how long, and they want to know, how does it work? How do you live as a Christian in that office building? How do you live as a Christian while running that business? How do you do it? And vocational discipleship is taking people, teachers and students, who have the same passion, same gifting, same calling in life that God's given both of them, and they're pairing one another up so that the older lawyer turns to the younger aspiring lawyer and says, look, this is what you need to deal with. This is what I had to deal with. This is what you need to start thinking about. This is how I live my Christian principles in my office. You need to start thinking about living your Christian principles in the same way. That's what vocational discipleship looks like. So, who are you discipling? That's my question. Who are you discipling? Because when I gave that intro question of which one of your friends are still at church, I can point to the 24 friends that I thought about who are not in church anymore, and they decided that they were not going to stay in relationship with the church. They decided that they were going to cut off their friendships with the church. They did not commit themselves to the community of the church. That's what they decided to do. Now, obviously, there could be reasons. I don't believe in God anymore. I don't like that church program. I don't feel like I belong in the church. There could be a bunch of other reasons. But ultimately, what keeps us sticking around is because we have friendships. We have family here. We have relationships here. And we have mentors here. Someone has mentored you. Someone has spoken life and spoken Jesus' commands over you and taught you how to become a Christian. And now my question is, who are you discipling? Because I don't want that to happen to my kids. I don't want that to happen to our youth group. I don't want that to happen to any of you guys, where you guys show up and then decide that you are not committed to this family and you guys just head out and don't attend church anymore. Who are you discipling? Discipling the next generation is going to require more than Pastor Jack discipling all 100 of us. Because that's what Moses tried to do. Moses couldn't do it all. He taught the next generation what it meant to obey God's commandments. Raising up the next generation requires all of us, every single one of you who are sitting here, all of us to obey Jesus' command. What was Jesus' command? Make disciples, teach them what I taught you guys. Make disciples, every single one of you, make disciples, teach them what I taught you. Who are you discipling? Who could you be discipling? Now, some of you, probably most of you, are already discipling somebody. Maybe it's your children. Maybe it's your grandchildren. Maybe you can start with that one person at church who is pursuing the same career as you. Maybe one of these young people are asking you, you know, what does it mean to be a teacher in SFUSD? How does it look? How do you stay a Christian within that context? Maybe there's a kid at school for you youth. Maybe there's a kid at school that reminds you of yourself when you were at their age. Maybe you're a senior and you don't ever talk with freshmen, but maybe you want to go out of your way some Sundays to talk with them. Maybe that person, it's a person who looks like they carry the same spiritual gifts as you. Who are you discipling? Who can you talk to? And start with who you're already friends with. Start with those younger people who you already kind of know their name. You don't have to introduce yourself. You already know their name. You already kind of know who they are. And start with them. Figure out a time to have lunch with them. Find out what they're doing. Ask them how you can pray for them. Just basic little things like that just to find out who they are. Is each of us discipling? Because if you're not discipling someone, we're not following Jesus' command to make disciples and to teach them what Jesus taught his disciples. Be intentional about discipling the next generation. Teach them what you've learned in the Bible. Many of us have so many different. Actually, last week at baptism, I was just so happy listening to all of the stories where everyone had so many different stories of how they, of their experiences with God, of how God used them in their lives. And God uses people in so many different ways. How can you take your personal story, your unique God-given story of how God affected you and your life, how can you share that with someone else who's younger than you? How can your story help someone else who's younger? who may not have lived as long as you and who haven't gone through all those experiences. Teach them what you've learned about being a Christian. Teach them what you've learned about being a Christian on the job. The jobs today, when it comes to living Christian principles, especially in San Francisco, it's really tough. I was talking with one of my friends the other day where she's really, really scared to tell anyone that she's a Christian at her workplace because of just what she's overheard her coworkers talking about Christians and how they're this and that and just really negative. And she's freaked out. How do you live like that? How do you live in the context of working in that environment? If you figured it out, some of these young people are wondering the same thing. How do I do it? Some of the college students who come back over the summer, many of you guys know the college students. How were you able to remain faithful to your faith after college, through college? What did you learn during that time? If you're a college student now, tell the seniors who are about to graduate what to expect, what it means to live a Christian life on a college campus. Because the 24 people that are in my head right now who left church, they left right after college. Because college is really a life-changing period of time for most of them. Be open to learning from someone. And finally, be open to learning from someone who's younger than you. Now, some of us, some of you who maybe not in that millennial age, we sometimes get into the temptation of, well, I've learned everything. I've lived a long life, and I don't need to learn anything else. That temptation, just think of it this way. You can help someone who's younger by asking them, hey, what is that app on your phone? Teach me how to use it. And that person, now they could teach you how to, like, teach you how to do, I don't know, Snapchat or whatever it is. They could teach you, and you could probably like forget how to use it. I forgot who taught me how to use Snapchat, but I completely forgot how to use it. But it doesn't matter. They were able to find some importance, some value in teaching someone older. It doesn't matter what. Just ask someone younger. Hey, tell me about your experience, or teach me how to do this or that, whatever it is. For me, it's usually something on my phone. Teach me what it means, and that person will feel so much value in someone older asking them, "How do you do that?" Be open to learning from someone younger than you. So my final question is, who are you discipling? Because statistics say that most people don't stick around church because they haven't been mentored, they haven't been discipled, someone older than them hasn't taught them what it means to be a Christian at their workplace, what it means to be a Christian, how to live a Christian life. Who are you discipling? And I challenge you to pick at least one person to go up to them and say, how can I pray for you? How has your week been? Treat them out to lunch, whatever it looks like. That one person that you have in your mind right now, call them up, email them, find a way to disciple them. Because our church, the American church, needs people to step up and to follow what Jesus commanded us to do, to make disciples and to teach them. Let me pray for all of us.